case, which we will hear today, and I will not be sitting in that case, so that will explain my leaving the bench. First case is 00-2861, Jane Marshall Osborne versus the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System. Mr. Kelly.
Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court. My name is Daniel Kelly, and it is my honor to represent J. Marshall Osborne and the Center for Equal Opportunity in this case. This case is about whether the state of Wisconsin will continue to honor its statutory and common law promise to the people of Wisconsin that they shall always have maximum access to the information upon which public officials rely in making their decisions and their policies. There are three issues before the Court upon which the Court of Appeals must be reversed. The first is this: whether the Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act keeps the University of Wisconsin system from producing non-personally identifiable information contained in education records. The Court of Appeals erred when it decided that the promise to the people of the state of Wisconsin must be broken, and the university may keep all of the information secret, regardless of whether it is personally identifiable or otherwise. The second issue is whether the federal act even applies to individuals who have not attended the institution from which the records have been requested. By placing their own interpretation of a regulation ahead of the clear and unambiguous terms of the controlling statute, the Court of Appeals decided that the federal act applies not only to students, but also to individuals who have never attended the institution from which the records have been requested. The third issue is whether the records custodians may be excused from their statutory duty to grant access to records containing both disclosable and non-disclosable information by redacting the non-disclosable and producing the balance. It appears that the Court of Appeals has decided that records custodians have no obligation to redact when a record contains both types of information, disclosable and non-disclosable.
If we hold against you on issue on what you have stated as issue one and two, we need not reach. I take it we need not reach that third issue.
That would be correct. I'd like to discuss the terms of the federal act. The federal act, as it applies to this case, is not a compendium of things the university may and may not do. It is not exhaustive on that topic. It only lists the things that the university may not do. And in this case, it says it may not do two things. It may not take an entire education record and give that to Mr. Osborne or the Center for Equal Opportunity. Second thing it may not do is lift personally identifiable information from that record and produce that to Mr. Osborne or the CEO. But we've not asked that the university do either one of those things. We have asked only that they produce non-personally identifiable information.
Mr. Kelly, for my own information, did the university system provide any responses, provide any information in regard to these requests?
They did provide information with respect to, in the larger context of the request that we made. They did not provide information with respect to the requests that are at issue here. That is, they provided some aggregated data, some information on policies, and so on. But with respect to the non-personally identifiable information that would be regarding each individual student, the test scores, the GPAs, race, gender, ethnicity, they've provided none of that information. Now, I believe that the federal act, the actual very language of the federal act, really dictates this conclusion. The language says the covered institution may not have a policy or practice of permitting the release of education records, paren, or personally identifiable information contained therein, other than directory information, close paren, of students without the written consent of their parents. Now, what's happened is both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals have given force and effect only to a part of that language. They've read up to the parenthetical and stopped there and said education records cannot be released. But as the court well knows, a statute should not be read in such a way that part of it is mere surplusage or redundant to other language already in the act. And that's precisely what would happen here. Because What the language says is, you can't release the whole record. And parenthetically, by the way, when you release information from an education record, you must make sure that it is not personally identifiable. If you don't add the parenthetical in, there's no point for having that language there unless that means that non-personally identifiable information is not covered by the statute.
Counsel, just after listening to your argument and Justice Ablich's question about the first two questions, I want to jump to three simply because I'm trying to think of a way, and I think the university is concerned about how to redact, if that were the decision of this court, how to redact these records and preserve the anonymity of the individual. And do you have any suggestion? Because this court, either we're going to have to remand it back for someone to figure out how to properly redact it. Do you have any suggestion for this court if that were the decision?
Well, I do. I think there's two ways that the university could produce this information. Although it is not required to produce a new record, it can, if it decides that as an administrative matter it's easier to do so, it may simply produce a report with this information. I suspect the information is contained in a computer somewhere. However, because this case was determined in the circuit court on a motion to dismiss, the factual record was never developed. So I believe that's a possibility. However, if they choose not to produce a new record, which they have no obligation to do so, then they can go in and they can simply redact the non-personally identifiable information from the records. And that can be done through whatever means, covering up, blacking out, however they choose to do that. And I agree that they do need to be careful that the information that is released is not personally identifiable, and we're completely confident that the university will be capable of reviewing their records.
Well, for example, and we're just looking at the system, and I don't want to overstate the numbers, but I believe they're in the thousands, tens of thousands, I think would be a very conservative estimate. And that seems to be part of their argument, how this is just a very daunting task to do this, to go through this, to provide this information. Now, that is...
Yeah. Well, Justice Wilcox, you've brought up a very important point, and I think we begin with the record does not disclose, the record does not disclose how many records there are. There has been no factual development in this case whatsoever. But presuming that the records are voluminous, again, if the university should decide that it is more efficient for them to produce a computer record, there will be no objection from Mr. Osborne or the CEO on that basis. Otherwise, the state does have an obligation to make this kind of information available. If it takes a while for them to do that, it takes a while and we'll wait. But that in and of itself, the difficulty of producing the records cannot alone stand in the way of the statutory and long common law mandate that the maximum access to the information upon which public officials rely in making their decisions and policies must be honored. This court is, I'm sorry.
Please finish.
I was just going to say that this court has previously held that this kind of access to information is at the bedrock, the very base of tenet of democracy. So I think that unless there's a factual record that demonstrates that the university would come to a grinding, screeching halt if they were to honor this request, I think we must presume that they'd be capable of doing so. And might I add, since the state has taken the liberty of introducing the allegation that there are so many thousands of records it'll be difficult for them to do this, the CEO has made this request of numerous universities prior to the University of Wisconsin. And in fact, there are 16 public universities that have responded to this request, and none of them have come to an administrative halt.
Is that a matter of this record?
It's not a matter of this record, nor is the burdensomeness argument. That is, we introduced that information in our motion to strike just to demonstrate that the information that the university is asking this court to rely on to say it's too hard to respond to this, we would have an opportunity, we would have facts available to us to respond in a trial that, in fact, this is not the kind of request that brings universities to their knees. In fact, this is a common practice, and it's been done in 16 universities previously. But that fact is not, not a record.
Mr. Kelly, when you say 16 universities have complied, are you talking about complying with all of these requests?
All of the, yes, with all of these requests.
Was there redaction that occurred?
There was redaction. In every instance, the CEO has asked that personally identifiable information be redacted, and in every case, that's been honored.
Counsel, walk me through what your proposal would be. Let me assume that the university gets 100,000 applications a year for admission. And let me assume that you're asking for the last 6 years. And let me assume that no personally identifying information is to be released. Now, is the fact that I may have been number one in my class and from in the year of, oh, let me pick 1982, this is a hypothetical, and from Richland Center, Wisconsin.
That's possible.
What, Richland Center? Are they supposed, is the university with this hypothetical 100,000 a year, hypothetical last 6 years? I mean, clearly they'll take off my name, clearly they'll take off my address, but that's personally identifying information. Are they to go through each and every one to say, oh, well, maybe this might lead to the identity being revealed? How is this to occur?
I think what needs to happen, Justice Bradley, is that the university needs to propose a list of information that they believe that they can release without it being personally identifiable. They've never done that to this point. They've simply said, we're not going to release any information whatsoever. We would certainly entertain their position that we can release this segment of information or rank for us the importance of the information that you're requesting. We'll go down, we'll mark a cutoff line beyond which we believe the information will be personally identifiable. Because I agree, there is a possible constellation of information that would allow you to identify an individual, and we don't want that. And I think what we need to, for instance, what our position would be if we were to follow the path of ranking the information that we want, it would be this: test scores, GPA, race, gender, ethnicity. Those would be the primary pieces of information that we would be asking for. None of those could reasonably be construed as being personally identifiable.
Well, it could be if, for instance, class, and there are plenty of small classes, that has only one, Mexican.
It's a very good point, Justice Babich. And in that case, we would anticipate that the university would say, sorry, you can't have that information. That's personally identifiable, and that would be completely acceptable.
So they would have to comb through these 100,000 requests, each one because of, I mean, to find that information?
Well, let me say this. I'm not sure they would have to comb through 100,000 records to find out that information. I think as an aggregate basis, that information is already at hand. So they can find out if there is a class on a particular campus where there's only one Hispanic American or one Native American that would fit into that. And they can say just as a matter of course, well, we're not going to disclose that information because the population is too small. It'll be personally identifiable. So it'll be easy for them to correlate with the kind of information we're looking for. They can take their aggregate data that they already have, and I believe they post on their website. They can take that and say, these are the classes of information we can't give you, and then go through and produce the balance. In addition, on this point of how this is going to work out as a pragmatic matter, I think we need to keep in mind that because there's been no factual development in this record, we don't know what form these records take place. We don't know if it's just the raw data or if there's say, admission committee reports that are created that would have this information already culled from the education records that would make it much easier to produce. But none of that is a record because the case was decided on a motion to dismiss. There's been no factual development. So as a practical matter, I do believe that the redaction can take place, just as, if we're going to speak outside the record, just as the other 16 universities have done so. They've honored the requests, they've redacted, they're still up and running. I have no reason to doubt that the University of Wisconsin system is as technically competent as any other university system in the United States. I believe they can do this. Now, with respect to whether or not the information, all of the information contained in an education record is subject to secrecy, this court has already laid the foundation to say that it is not. In the Hathaway case, this court decided that the factual circumstances in that case were these. The school district had taken non-personally identifiable information from a pupil record, created a list. The list was the student's parents' names and contact information. And this court said, just because the information was taken out of a confidential record does not mean that that information is confidential. So you've already laid the basis to say that there is information in a record which cannot be disclosed in its entirety, a piece of which can be disclosed. The only question then is, how's that going to get done? And in this case, what we're saying is the university can take one of two approaches. They can copy it out into a separate record if they want, or they can redact the non-disclosable information and present the balance. Either way, the result is the same. If you copy it out, you've got the exact same data as if you redact. Two things. This court has already established that the copied data is subject to disclosure. In the context of the Federal Act, there's nothing there that precludes the disclosure of non-personally identifiable information. So the same analysis should apply. Now, with respect to whether the Federal Act applies to individuals who have never attended the institution from which the records have been requested, that's, I think, a much more straightforward question. In this circumstance, the Court of Appeals decided that a regulation was at odds with a statute, and they gave effect to the terms of the regulation instead of the statute. As this court well knows, that is not the order of precedence between regulations and statutes. The regulation, in any event, is not contradictory at all to what the statute proclaims. In fact, the statute and the regulation have the same two identical basic elements, and that is attendance at the institution from which the records have been requested. Both of them contain that. The Court of Appeals, when it was construing the regulation, gave effect to only half of the regulatory definition that they decided was in contravention of the statute. They said that a student is someone who has attended any institution at any time. But that's not what the regulation says. The regulation says it's an individual who has attended an institution and about whom that institution maintains educational records. There's still that link between the attendance and the institution maintaining the records, just like there is in the statute. So it was error for the Court of Appeals to apply the regulation in derogation of the statute.
Counsel, if you prevail on the first issue,
yes,
if the court should hold that the Federal Act does not preclude the disclosure of this redacted information, do you really care about your second issue?
I do not. The first would subsume the second.
Yes.
And I do believe that the first is the more compelling argument. This is not a novel question. It's novel in Wisconsin, but it's not a question that's never been addressed in the court before.
Okay, well, what if you lose on the first issue? Do you really care what we do with the second issue?
And I do care.
You do care?
I do. Because at the very least, Mr. Osborne, the CEO, would have access to information that would establish what test scores, GPAs, and so on do not get you admitted.
Okay.
We don't have the other side of the equation, but that's useful information nonetheless.
Okay, that was a question that was in the back. Well, you know, if they lose that, the big one, why would, where the, okay, so assuming, now I assume, though, and I recognize that you do care about that second issue. This is what concerns me there. Let's take a hypothetical of the student from one of the schools that is in attendance in the class today, in the court today. And that student applies to University of Wisconsin at Madison, University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire, and the University of Wisconsin at Oshkosh. That student gets accepted at Oshkosh, but not at the other two. Now, according to the way I understand your argument, you believe, even if we should hold it, you're not entitled to that. That FERPA covers those records. And she isn't in no question then that she's going to, he or she's going to be in attendance at Oshkosh. Nevertheless, you can reach the records at Madison and at Eau Claire because they're not in attendance. Is that your argument?
That is the basic contours of the argument, Justice Batlish. The important factor is...
But does that make sense to you? Because, you know, there's an old saying in the law that you can't accomplish by indirection what you can't accomplish by direction. And that, this is certainly a classic case.
Well, it would be a classic case of it if the CFR had not, if the Secretary had not already provided otherwise. And this is this very hypothetical is one that the Court of Appeals raised and the University has raised. And in the Court of Appeals, we cited the Court to the controlling regulation. It's 34 CFR 99.5. And basically what it says is if you are in attendance at one component of the university system, but you've applied at other components, you don't have any rights with respect to the records that are held at the other components of the university system unless you enroll and attend. So that question has been answered, but I think the more significant point is this. The fact that the federal act does not provide protection does not mean that members of the general public are simply going to be able to walk in and rifle through all kinds of personally identifiable information. This court has previously established that the statutory right to privacy and the common law right to privacy and reputational interest applies in the open records context, which is why Mr. Osborne, the CEO, did not make a distinction between its request for individuals who have enrolled and attended and those who have not. Because in any event, the personally identifiable information has to be redacted, whether it's because of the requirements of the federal act, or because of Wisconsin statutes 895.50, or because of the policy that we discover in the open meetings law under section 19.85, or whether it's the common law right to privacy, or right in your reputational interests, that information still has to get redacted. So whether or not the federal act applies does not mean that these good students are going to have their personally identifiable information spread all over the universe. It's just a question of the source of the protection. And the Congress and the Secretary of Education have made it clear that the extent of the protection provided by the federal act only goes so far. And that extent is with respect to the institutions that the individual has actually attended.
Mr. Kelly, how do you handle the argument that requiring redaction of these records is in effect creating new records and that there's no obligation on the part of the university system to create new records?
Justice Crooks, the way I would respond to that is the very statute that upon which we rely in asking for the redaction explains how this is to be accomplished in section 19.36. And that specifically says, in the same section that says you don't get to make the university create new records. It says the way you do this is through redaction. So it cannot be that redaction is the same thing as creating a new record. Because on the one hand, we know that they have no duty to create a new record. And on the other hand, we know they have a duty to redact.
Well, doesn't the state argue that 19.36 is inapplicable in this situation?
They do argue that, Justice Brooks. And I think that that is an error for this reason. 19.36 applies precisely and only in the situation that is currently at bar. And that is when the entirety of a record is exempt from disclosure. 19.36 assumes a record that is exempt from disclosure. It then says, all right, how do we produce the information in there that is not non-disclosable? Well, we do that by redacting. We redact the non-disclosable, and we produce the balance. So 19.36 is directly applicable. It assumes the precise factual situation before the court, and it says your duty, your statutory duty, is to redact.
Did you indicate that the 16 public universities that you referred to were listed somewhere in the record?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. They are not listed in the record. We brought that up in response to, we brought those up in our motion to strike the university's brief because they were relying on extra record facts. And that is that this would be too burdensome for them to do and that it would potentially shut down the university. We put that in our motion to demonstrate that if there were to be a factual, if there had actually been a trial in this case, and if they had actually made that argument, that we would have been able to respond to that. But there's actually a more fundamental problem with the argument that they're making on the burdensomeness issue, and that is that the records custodian never raised that. Now, under the Oshkosh case, this court has decided that it is the records custodian's duty, it is the records custodian's duty to bring up the bases upon which a request for disclosure must be denied. In fact, it says in that case, in Fox v. Bach, that it is not the record custodian's attorney or the court's duty to rifle around to find a basis upon which a denial may be based. And there's only one exception to that, and that's when there's a specific statutory prohibition against the release of information requested. That's the only time that the court can de novo say, even though the records custodian did not bring that up, that is the basis for a denial. But burdensomeness is not a statutory exception to the duty to disclose. So that has to be brought up by the records custodian when they deny the request. And that wasn't done. It was not done in the circuit court. And the first time this argument made its appearance was in the Court of Appeals. So there's the additional problem that the issue should not be brought up for the first time on appeal. And I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. We'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Alan Lee, Assistant Attorney General of Madison, representing the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System.
May it please the Court, I am Alan Lee, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System. The university has released all of the requested information, almost 400 pages of records. The only records not released were individual student application, individual student records. That is, I don't have the record site, but it is in the complaint, which is part of the record, Exhibit B to the complaint, page 2. The university informed the requesters that the information sought, the part that is being denied, is maintained only in the education records of individual students and applicants. It is not somewhere in a university computer. The information that was somewhere in a university computer has been given.
So how many records are we talking about over the years that were requested?
I think my calculation based on the public information available on the university's website was undergraduate records of approximately 450,000. I cannot off the top of my head remember the numbers for law school and medical school, but obviously appreciably less than that, since the numbers of applicants are much smaller. So that the records we're talking about here are those individual student applications, the ones that these students submit to the University of Wisconsin and Madison and Green Bay and Milwaukee. These are often, in fact, almost always done on paper. They are sent to individual campuses. The individual campuses keep those records. The university does not have a central depository or repository of these in Madison. And as I have said and cannot emphasize enough, it is not that the university has this information in a computer and is refusing to give it up. It does not have this information in any form except student applications.
Both. So what information
if any. Now, your opposing counsel indicated that you haven't given them any information. I know you released the 90 pages, but under the open records law and FERPA, and if the right of the public to perhaps know what's going on, what, if any, records would the university make available if you had this request?
The university has made available those records which it thinks it can make available. And it also has the records on the website. I assume those are part of what was released.
So, as I gather, the argument, and, you know, we have the three parts, but I'm skipping over the first to get to the redaction part. What I think is your argument is that, A, it's too burdensome. We do not have these records. And I don't know if it would literally shut the university down, but that the information is not in a repository that's, you know, that we could produce it in any fashion other than be very, very difficult. Is that?
Well, there are some other problems with the potential redaction, if that's the issue you wish me to speak about. Besides the burdensomeness, which is awesome because we're talking about essentially paper records here, the university can never be quite sure if it is redacting enough information from any individual record to protect that individual's identity.
Well, let me just ask in the follow-up, because I asked opposing counsel the same question. The information that you're saying is not available on a computer. You suggested, well, we could get this off a computer, or you could put it on computer records. You're saying it is not there.
It is not there. It is in individual student applications that students mail in to the various campuses. Some of them do it electronically, but I would think most are still coming by mail.
Why is your argument even relevant? I mean, we hear this argument all the time from public people who say, well, it's inefficient or it's burdensome upon us to release these public records. The statute doesn't talk about burdens.
Well, I think there are degrees. Well, the statute, I think, does. It says you don't have to create a record. And essentially what they are asking the university to do here is either go through an absolutely impossible task of redacting those individual records or deciding to create a record, which is exactly what the statute says the university does not have to do.
You're not taking, let me ask this more gently. You're not taking the position, are you, counsel, that redacting any record constitutes, per se, creating a new record?
No, absolutely not. I'm saying, and for another reason here, that might be the university's only option here. And here is the reason.
Before you get to that reason, you understand that one of the reasons given by the university for failure to disclose, as I understood it, is that redaction constitutes creation of a new record?
They said they would have to create a new record, yes.
And the reason. Does the Court of Appeals opinion, as you read it, assert that premise?
I think it agrees with that premise. I don't think there was much discussion of it in the Court of Appeals decision, is my recollection.
To the extent that the Court of Appeals opinion can be read for the premise that redacting a record constitutes per se creation of a new record, to the extent it can be read that, you would disagree with that
I would.
Interpretation.
But here is the problem the university faces. We have individual student applications, hundreds of thousands of them. It cannot go through each one with any confidence and know that it has redacted enough information to protect that student's identity. Justice Bradley's example is one example. Another example, I think Justice Babbage came close to suggesting it, there may be only one Native American or one African American in a class, in a high school class, that has applied to the University of Wisconsin. There may be only one student from a high school that has applied at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, for example. There is no way the people who are doing those redactions would know that. They can't. It's just impossible to know. They therefore could, in the best of faith, redact all the information they think should be redacted, and the person would still be identifiable. For example, what about information that you're class president, that you were on the track team, that you were on the debate club and honor society? In a lot of high schools, that would identify somebody. And you can take out the name, the address, the social security number, and everything else that you want to, and the person's grade point and class rank would be there.
What about redacting all information but for the grade point, average, race, gender, test scores, and ethnicity?
I think you would still run the risk of having people identified because of race and class rank. Would not take much in a lot of Wisconsin high schools to put those two together and identify somebody.
I'm not getting the full picture then. Why does the high school even have to be identified?
Because the request is for applications to the University of Wisconsin system.
But why do you have to identify the high school or the town at all? I'm talking about test scores, GPA, race, gender, and ethnicity.
Well, then we'd have to redact more and more. And at some point, you end up with almost nothing. We haven't essentially created a new record.
But is it? I guess when I'm listening to this, Justice Bradley's question raised, well, that if you redact, that would be the, would seem to me, that would be the way to do it, because you would not make it easily identifiable, and yet you would comply with the request for information. And this is just following up on Justice Bradley's question. In other words, the plaintiffs here don't want, appellants want certain pieces of information, and certainly by providing that and just redacting everything else, that's true. You would redact almost everything except that information.
But I think if you look especially at what the plaintiffs asked for from the law school and the medical school, you will see it goes much beyond grade point and where they graduated from. They asked for extracurricular activities, geographic origin, all sorts of information. Undergraduate grade point, I think where they went to school. If that's the information they're asking for, that's the information we cannot give. And here is the big concern. If the university guesses wrong on redacting, and the Department of Education decides that we have essentially released records in violation of FERPA, the university risks losing its federal funding. That's more than a couple bucks.
Well, what is the information that you think could be released that would not in any way jeopardize identification of an individual student?
I think you would have to go through the records, and you could probably release, without identifying the high school, you could release grade point.
Age?
I suppose so, yes. And probably race if they've included it, but they don't have to.
Race? What else?
I don't know what else they've asked for.
Gender?
If the high school is not identified, yes.
Ethnicity?
Yeah, please.
Ethnicity?
I think I said yes.
Test scores?
Now we're getting much more specific. You also run into the problem.
Just stop there. You're getting more specific. How would we release the test score?
The more information you release, the closer you can come to identifying an individual. What if there's only one person who applied at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and somebody, Mr. Osborne and the CEO are only two requesters? If this court holds that these are public records that can be released and have to be redacted, there can be hundreds of other requesters for the same information. And at some point, the university has to decide, now what information can we give this person that can't match up with that one? What information do we withhold that can't be matched up? Because if they are wrong, the Department of Education comes after them, and even if this court has ordered them to do it, the Department of Education is not bound by this court's decision.
Mr. Lee, do you agree that 16 public universities have provided such information?
I have no reason to disagree.
Is it your knowledge that in any of those instances, the federal government went after those universities and said you violated the law, we're going to get you, we're going to take away the
funds? I'm not aware that they have.
Well, then, why should the University of Wisconsin system be so concerned?
I don't know to what extent the university had that information, quote, in their computers that we don't have in our computers. That's the big difference. Universities, different universities use application information, pull certain parts of those, of that information off applications for their own purposes. They generate reports, see how they're doing from various high schools, geographic areas, whatever, race included. But what would happen here is the university is being asked to pull more information off those applications than it has need for. It doesn't want this. It doesn't do this on its own. It is creating a record.
Yeah, well, we're looking basically, at least my view is that it's a balancing. And you have the obligation of the public right to know balanced with the right of privacy. And the more you get away from identifiable information, the more the balance would seem to go to some type of a release. Otherwise, in a university system, if someone wanted to know this information and the university said, well, we won't release it because it might identify somebody, and there was a, let's say, reasonable way of ascertaining that information, there's really no public scrutiny on, in this case, they're talking about the admission policy or who's getting in, or... So how would one find out that information?
I disagree with the premise
that
these are public records for this reason. I think the
is that your basic position, that these are not public records?
Yes.
Within
I
the
think
statute?
They are confident. Well, public records in the sense they're held by a public authority, certainly. Okay. The question is, are they available to the public?
Right.
I was using shorthand, and I apologize. Bad habit. The question is, under FERPA, there's no doubt that student records are confidential. Mr. Osborne and the CEO agree with that. What is Wisconsin's policy on student records? Section 118.125 says student records, uses the word pupil, records are confidential.
Does that apply to the university system?
It does not, and that's why the university didn't cite it. But it certainly applies to all of those records that the university gets from high schools.
Only public high schools. Presumably some private high school students apply for the university.
There is some 437 or something public high schools in Wisconsin, 65 private. It also raises the interesting question, what about applications from out of state? Are those suddenly public, but the ones in Wisconsin are confidential? Those are the kind of weird questions we get into here if we try to parse a statute, especially FERPA, because FERPA doesn't really prohibit this. FERPA says you can release or not release. We don't care, but you better not make a mistake. But Wisconsin's overriding public policy is in Section 118.125. And it says, very simply, sub 2, all pupil records are confidential, except as provided in the rest of this statute. What else can the legislature say to make records confidential? Can they say all pupil records are confidential? We really mean it? Back to your point, Justice Wilcox. Legislature makes other records confidential. Tax records, medical records, juvenile records. Under Mr. Osborne's theory, if someone was interested in the auditing practices of the Department of Revenue, they could make a public records request to the department. The department would have to redact the personally identifiable information from all those tax records and then provide those records to the requester and any other requester, presumably. What else can the legislature do to make a record confidential? It has done it here.
This is the quandary I have. Now, let me refer just in part to the facts of the United States Mathey versus Johnston case, 1976. And in that case, plaintiffs brought an action challenging the procedures used by Mississippi replacing children with handicap conditions in specialized classes. Now, I would guess that, and I take that as a general fact situation because it's hard for anyone to say it's good public policy not to accommodate, or put it the other way, it is good public policy to accommodate kids who need specialized classes or that are considered handicapped. So in other words, I'm looking at the agenda. My concern is this. What if you have a school district that doesn't provide the kinds of classes necessary for handicapped children? What if you have a university, a public university, that is discriminating based on ethnicity? Isn't that something the public should be entitled to ascertain?
I think the public should be able to ascertain that, but not necessarily through the public records law.
Well, how else? Let's say the university system of XYZ is discriminating, and I believe it's discriminating. And I'm a citizen, and I don't think a public university should be discriminating. And so I want the records to see whether or not they are violating the law. And you're telling me you can't have those records.
I am saying the legislature has said you can't have those records. Just like the legislature has said, you may be concerned that the Department of Revenue is not doing a very good job, but you can't go through people's tax records to make that determination. That's what legislative oversight is for. That's what legislative audit bureau is for. That's what a lot of other oversight agencies are for. The public records law is not a cure-all for all the ill, for all of the ills of government.
We're looking at the big picture here, but I can nuance it. Where has the legislature said that with regard to the universities?
It hasn't, and it didn't have to, because our law was passed 2 years after FERPA, based absolutely on FERPA.
Mm-hmm. But before you can say that the federal legislation covers this, you have to all students, you have to say it covers students who have applied but are not attending the university.
Correct.
And it seems to me that that's a debatable question. I know how the Court of Appeals solved it, but I think it's a debatable question whether or not those students who have applied but are not in attendance as required by the federal legislation, whether or not they're even covered.
But this court has always held correctly that what you look at is the nature of the records, not where they're held. And I reference back to Justice Babbage's hypothetical of applying at 3 or 4 different schools within the University of Wisconsin system. We have the exact same records at 3 schools that supposedly are now public, and at the 4th school are confidential.
But this court has always held also that if the words are plain, that you should follow the plain words set forth in the statute.
And the plain words, the overriding public policy. Confidential. There is nothing in either law that suggests that because you apply to a different school, your admittedly educational, your private educational records suddenly become public.
What about the federal regulation 99.5?
I think quite clearly that is meant to take care of the situation where I apply at a university and do not get accepted. I cannot use FERPA to access my admission records. I think the federal the history of the statute is fairly clear on that. They did not want students who are denied admission being able to use FERPA to go into their records. If that is not the case, if the law is different, then you have really strange things going on in FERPA. For example, under FERPA, a student does not have access to his or her parents' financial information. That's part of the application process.
Well, I go along with that part of it.
As I do. My son, however, disagrees. But if FERPA doesn't apply, if that student applies and doesn't get accepted and therefore isn't covered by FERPA, theoretically, that student under FERPA has access to his or her parents' financial information. That makes no sense. That, we have to be very careful about making any law that absurd.
Okay. Good point. But why do you even get to the federal regs? Why don't you just look at the statute? It seems clear on its face.
Well, I think, again, FERPA doesn't answer the question. Yes, we can release under FERPA. We risk a couple dollars in change if we guess wrong. But the question here is, what are the rights of the requester under Wisconsin's public records law? FERPA wasn't meant to trump public records laws. And I submit to you, the overriding public policy in Wisconsin on student records is confidentiality. That's all the statutes say. FERPA says that, and 118.125 says that. And there is no duty to redact whatsoever under sections 19.361 or 19.366 if the record does not contain, quote, public information, or under 19.36 if the information is not subject to disclosure under the public records law.
So I take it, and I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, go ahead.
It is, your opposing counsel said, they have offered us nothing, and as I listened to your last statement, if there is no possible redaction, and these records are, under both federal and state law, confidential, that the position is clearly that you're not going to give anything, redaction or otherwise.
Correct.
Okay.
Just as if the request were made to the
department. Several of my colleagues were just trying a hypothetical testing where we might go with
certainly.
This, but the position is one that nothing goes.
Yes, excuse me. The position is there is absolutely no duty to redact here whatsoever. And even if we were ordered to do so, we would essentially have to create a record in order to be careful under FERPA.
But see, that comes back to, well, then, as Justice Bradley asked, where is any public overview? How can we test this? Nobody gets an opportunity to, is it just because we say so, and that's...
It's because the legislature has said so, yes. I think that's who sets the public policy on openness.
Oh, yes, I understand.
And they have said, point blank.
But the legislature also says, whatever the statute is, that there shall be no discrimination. There's a specific statute, maybe you know it more quickly than I do, that there shall be pupil discrimination prohibited, 118.13.
Yes.
So, what if I believe that discrimination is taking place in a university system?
Well, Section 118 wouldn't apply to the university, but assume it's a high school. I think you go to the school board, you go to other oversight agencies and say, Department of Public Instruction, for example, in the case of a high school, and you say, here's what I think is going on, we want an investigation. As I've said, the public records law is not a cure-all for all of the ills of government. It was never intended to be so. And back to my point, which I cannot make strongly enough on Wisconsin's policy on student records, this court said in its Hathaway decision on page 400, quote, we agree that section 118.125 stats, the pupil record law, sets forth exceptions to the general rule that the public has the right to inspect public records. This court has recognized that Wisconsin policy.
Hold it, I don't get it. You're citing 118.125 for your premise that on public records, but when I say cite 118.13, you say it doesn't apply to universities.
And I've said 118 does not apply to the university on public records, except the policy of the legislature applies. Many of these records, probably most of these records, are going to be high school records. They're records that are confidential under 118.125. Does 118.125 say, and when you apply it to the University of Wisconsin system, your confidentiality is out the window? No, it doesn't. It authorizes a student to send
My kids are applying to universities, or they will be soon, applying to universities. The record, the application form that they submit is not a pupil record under 118.125, is it? They're applying to UW Stevens Point and applying to University of Minnesota. Is that application record, a record under 118.1?
Probably not, but the records that they authorize their high schools to send certainly are.
Okay, but let's say your opponent doesn't want the stuff from the high school. They don't care if the high school sends a word. All they want is information from the application that my child is sending to the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And your child is sending that information to the University of Wisconsin system, I submit, expecting it to be held confidential. And I invite you to look at the application form that is attached to the brief. It's also on the Internet.
Okay. Maybe my child expects confidentiality, but you need a better answer than that. Because I want to know, because my child expects a lot of things. I want to know what the law is. Why does my child's application, written out in longhand, sent to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, why is that entitled to non-disclosure?
Because the federal and the state policies are absolutely coextensive, and that is that confidentiality in student records is the rule, not the exception. It trumps the public records law.
So my child's application long form is a student record. You're assuming that it is. If my child applies to the University of Wisconsin-Madison and does not get accepted or does not accept the acceptance, is that a student record? Don't you get back to that question?
Yes. I think under FERPA it is.
Well, isn't that an open question if that child doesn't attend at all?
Well, it's certainly an open question in the sense that we're here today, yes. Mm-hmm. But I think quite clearly it had better be, because otherwise the law is absurd. Mr. Osborne and the Center for Equal Opportunity, as I mentioned earlier, are only two requesters, and only two requesters to the University of Wisconsin system. If they prevail in this case, anyone can request this kind of record from the University of Wisconsin system and its myriad campuses and the 473 high schools, public high schools in Wisconsin, and hundreds of other public schools, middle schools, grade schools, elementary schools in Wisconsin. And the schools will have to consider those requests, redact the information, and provide the information to the requesters. That is nothing the public records law ever contemplated. It is nothing the legislature ever contemplated. The legislature has spoken clearly. It has adopted the FERPA policy of confidentiality. The university has complied in all respects with its duties under the public records law by providing all of the records it had subject to that law and trying to maintain the confidentiality of the other records. We ask the court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Kelly, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I think the most remarkable part of this is that the concern about burdensomeness and about all the other requesters that might be waiting out in the wings somewhere has not come to pass. The Manny T case decided that non-personally identifiable information contained in student records is not subject to secrecy. There's not been a run on that school. The Kristen versus Board of Education case, same thing, no run on that school. Human Rights Authority of Illinois versus Miller, same thing with respect to the Southern Illinois University, no run on that school.
Is that all part of the record?
That is part of the record. Those are cases that we have cited.
I mean, the fact that there's been no run on those schools.
That part is not part of the record, but there is nothing in those cases that indicated a concern that would occur. And I'm aware of no cases that have followed on as a result of those cases that have indicated that the universities or the school districts were in imminent danger of being closed down because of a run of public records requests. That is nowhere in the reported cases.
But Mr. Kelly, I assume that your clients are in good faith in requesting. You know, they're not looking to peer in somebody's house. What, at a minimum, do you need, do your clients need in order to accomplish what it is they are seeking to do?
At minimum, they need test scores, GPAs, race, gender, ethnicity.
Ethnicity?
Yes. If that's reported. Mm-hmm. And it may or may not be. We don't know.
What about the information contained on the application that pertains to parental information? You don't need that.
We have no need of that. And again, to the extent that that is personally identifiable information, that would be precluded from release both by the federal act mm-hmm. and by the Wisconsin statutes and common law. Again, there is a perfect mesh between the laws here. The federal act establishes its parameters, its umbrella of protection. The state law, when we're talking about pupil records, 118.125, establishes its umbrella of protection. However, as this court well knows, confidentiality can be waived. An individual asking that an elementary or a high school transmit its records to a university as part of an application process ought to know, and is charged with knowledge, that there's going to be a different level of protection or a different source of protection for that information. He's saying, I want you to send that information out. Now that information that he has asked to be sent is subject to the protection of the Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act, Section 895.50, 19.85, and this court's long history of protecting privacy rights and reputational interests. The protection is always still there. It is a seamless whole. It is just a question of the source of the protection. So what we have here is 118.125, protecting those records as long as they are in the hands of the K-12 system. If the student should ask that it be transferred out, then it's going to be subject to the protection offered by the other laws that apply in those circumstances. But in any event, the information is always protected. There is no circumstance in which we could ask for personally identifiable information in which we could force the university to hand that over. It can't be done. Whether or not it's because of the application of the federal act or state or common law, state statutes or common law.
What relief are you requesting? The prayer for relief set forth in your brief indicates that you want us to remand with instructions to issue a writ of mandamus. But that's not really what I heard you say in your earlier comments. So what are you really asking for?
Well, we would ask that the mandamus would issue to produce non-personally identifiable information. To the extent that the university believes that it is not capable of releasing information, to the extent that we've asked for it, without it being personally identifiable, then certainly there could be a hearing on the issue of how far down the list of information we want we can go without getting to personally identifiable information. But I think the mandamus needs to issue so that we can have that conversation.
Can you give me those again? You sort of went through them very fast.
I'm sorry. I would say what we need at a minimum would be test scores, GPA, race, ethnicity, and gender.
Not age, huh?
We don't need age.
When a student applies to a university, they do not necessarily have the test scores as part of their application. So how can you get the test scores? Give me the legal authority for that, accessing that information.
Well, we would ask for the test scores to the extent that the university has that in its possession, however that occurred. It may be that the student, as part of the application process, asked the school district to forward his or her test scores along to the university. And to that extent, they are disclosable in a non-personally identifiable fashion. So that's information that we believe the university will have. As its admission process, I'm assuming that they have actually looked at the GPA that the individual has achieved in their pre-university work. So the information should all be there in the hands of the university. They can provide it simply by taking away that which is personally identifiable. And we're more than happy to rank what we want as we have. And if the in that compilation of information, is not capable of identifying anyone, and therefore is not precluded from release by the Federal Act, 895.50, 1985, or any other case that this court has ever decided. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Thank you, Mr. Lee, for excellent arguments. Marshall, I understand these classes have to go off. The court will take a brief 5-minute recess to allow...